we're talking about a human being who still has contributions to make and feelings and wants to connect with us.
You are listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness, your number one resource for practical tips and insights, empowering you and your family to live well with Alzheimer's. Hello and welcome to episode 33 of The Alzheimer's Podcast. I'm Mike Good of Togetherness. Thank you for joining me for another podcast where my goal is always to empower you to maintain a positive experience, reduce and eliminate the need for medications, and make your time together with those you care for the best it can be. There are a lot of negative and unfair beliefs about Alzheimer's disease and the people who are living with the disease. Negative labels and pejorative terms are damaging to the care provided and contribute to approaches to care that focus on weakness rather than strength, illness rather than wellness, and victims rather than individuals. One of the biggest misconceptions is that life is over once a person has been diagnosed, but it's not. In fact, individuals with dementia and their families can and are living enriched and fulfilling lives with the disease. Today, we have another episode of Navigating Rough Terrain with the Dementia Sherpa. Christy Turner, the Dementia Sherpa, and I will be discussing societal attitudes about dementia. Christy joins me regularly for a discussion to help empower you to be successful as you care for someone living with dementia. She is a certified dementia practitioner, certified dementia care unit manager, and cognitive stimulation instructor. She has run award-winning memory care communities in assisted living and skilled nursing levels of care. Using her 16 years of experience in working with over 1,100 people living with dementia and their families, she's developed a system that helps families move from crisis management to confidence. Well, hello, Christy. Welcome to the show. And I'm looking forward to our discussion today on societal attitudes about dementia.
Hi, Mike. I am too. Thank you so much for having me back. I think this is a great topic.
Well, you're very welcome. And it's always a pleasure to have you here. So let's just go ahead and get started by having you share what you mean by societal attitudes about dementia.
Well, you know, I still hear, even in this day and age, so many pejorative words used about people living with dementia, and they're not accurate either. That's the other problem. So using words like crazy or stupid or wacko or demented or, you know, a psych problem, and it's just not helpful because, you know, how we talk about things, we're really expressing our thoughts about things, right? And it becomes this reinforcing circle. So I think if we can start talking about it differently, we can start thinking about it differently too, because we don't know what the future holds. You know, there could be many of us listening today who end up dealing with this diagnosis ourselves. And I hope that's not the case, but the fact is, for anybody listening today, we already know and love at least one person who has a diagnosis of dementia. And so, you know, I think when we put it in that context, this is people we know and love. Let's start talking about them differently and seeing what we can do to make their life better.
Exactly. The power of words and the way it affects us and how we respond and act is it's very powerful, and often it's just kind of subconscious too. So when we hear negative terms and dreariness, it just paints that image. And, you know, I use the term self-fulfilling prophecy, but, you know, a major emphasis of the Alzheimer's podcast is to help people have positive experiences. And I really think that the language we use, as you're saying, is key to that.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, there's that old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's a cute rhyme, but it is exactly the opposite. I've never met really anybody who has perseverated about a broken arm they got in second grade. you know.
Right, right.
But we can all go back to a moment where something really hurtful was said, at least one moment. You know, most of us have way, way more than that. So I agree. That's one of the reasons I love the podcast, is because I'm all about the positive also. This is the situation that nobody wants to find themselves in, certainly. And I definitely understand that. But we are here right now. So what can we do to maximize, optimize, improve somebody's quality of life?
So, Christy, what are some alternatives you like to use instead of these negative words and phrases?
Well, one thing I like to do is always put the person first, right?
Right.
And so a lot of times people will ask me, what should we call people living with dementia? Or, you know, my mom has dementia, you know, so how do you talk about that? Well, if it's a personal relationship, use their name. That's what I found works in any area of life, right?
Right.
So there's that. And the second thing is always, again, I say, and people who follow me or listen to me probably already picked up on this, I always say person living with dementia or people living with dementia. And I think one of the easiest parallels to draw is if we bring cancer into it, right? So I would say person living with cancer or person who has cancer. I would never say that somebody's cancered, right?
Right, that's a good point.
And yet we say demented. Well, no. Or cognitively impaired. And so if we just are mindful of putting the person first and the diagnosis second, then not only does it help inform our thinking about it, but it also helps remind us what's the important part here. And that's always the person.
True. And that brings a dignity and a respect to the forefront as well, right? It's instead of making it a label, putting a label on the person, we're seeing that person, personhood, that the individual.
Exactly. And that's why the Alzheimer's Association, you know, has been saying this for years. When you've met one person with Alzheimer's, you've met one person with Alzheimer's. And, you know, part of that is speaking to the differences that people may experience in the disease process from person to person. But more importantly, again, it's a person. So, you know, every Californian hasn't had the same life experience just because they have been a Californian in common, right? And again, when we think about it that way, we go, well, of course all Californians aren't the same. That's ridiculous to think that they're, you know, there's a bunch of bots, right? And same for people living with dementia. They all started off as distinctly unique human beings, and they still are. They just have this additional diagnosis now. And so there are definitely some strategies we know, some techniques that help in managing that condition. But again, it's a person first and foremost. I know, you know, in 17 years, I've worked with about 1,200 people living with dementia. I know some of them loved to cook. Some of them hated to cook. Some
right.
of them, you know, drove everywhere. Some had never driven in their lives. I mean, people just have a wide array of experiences. And when we keep going back to that and seeing, you know, this is a person, then we really, you know, we're showing up as our best self, and we're allowing them to do the same.
Right, that's true. And one of the terminologies I saw from the Alzheimer's Society, which has a really great PDF that I'll provide, that talks about person-centered language and how that, you know, and they give you the example of the negative words, but then they also give you examples on how to talk more positively and talk about the individual.
Right, what to say instead.
Exactly.
And there are some things that aren't specifically about the person, but related to maybe circumstances or people around the person, where it's the same type of thing. Like a lot of times I'll hear people say, oh, you know, Joe lives in that facility down the street. Well, that would be weird because nobody I know lives in a facility. Like facilities are where you manufacture widgets.
Exactly.
Right? But people do live in communities. Everybody I know lives in a community. Maybe, you know, any any place in the world, it's community. So that's another one. And then this one is an evolution that I really love because it always drove me just nuts seeing the evolution from caretaker to caregiver to care partner.
Right.
And, you know, caretakers are often, you know, that they work at golf courses or on an estate, right?
Right.
they're taking care of the grounds. And when you say giver, that's really, it's a lot of, it really takes any kind of equality out of the relationship, right? And so if it's your spouse or your parent, those are different types of relationships. But in a spousal relationship, of course, there's going to be equality. In a parent-child relationship, even though it's your parent who needs maybe some assistance from you, that's still a weird dynamic for you to, you know, as though when we're saying we're always giving, it's as though we've never received anything from the other person. And partnering is, you know what? We're in this together.
Right.
And that's the reality of the situation. We are in it together. We're together in this.
That was always one of the underlying themes to the choice for the name. And you know, I get a lot of, when I use the term care partner, so very few people understand what I mean, and I have to help explain it, but that's part of the education and helping the evolution, as you say.
Right. And I think that's something we've talked about before too, Mike, with, you know, with what we do. Of course, we want people to be able to find us.
Right.
So part of it is we have to use some of the same search terms that people use on Google so they can find us.
True.
But that's not necessarily the preferred language. And so I know sometimes I'll use something in a headline or in tags so that people can find it in a search, but take some time to explain why that's actually not the preferred thing in the actual content.
And we went through that with sundowning and shadowing.
Right, exactly.
There's a lot of passion out there in the professional world to help move society to this person-centered language. It's interesting to me because I've met and interact with people that are in the earlier process of the disease, and they're participating in society, and they're online, and they're active, and sometimes they get into the conversations about the words, and one of the things, you know, we have to, the words also create stigmas, right? And a lot of people haven't overcome the stigmas, so they tend to recoil into and become isolated.
Right. And that's, we're talking about real result from how we talk about this. And I would say real damage from how we talk about this. And that's just another point. Another thing that, and this is just one of my little soapbox crusades that has to change. It absolutely has to change is when we, I've had people talk to me so many times, come up to me after a speech that I've done, or even family members that I'm working with, and say things like, well, you know, I just, if this ever happens to me, I'm going to put a gun in my mouth, or, you know, I'd rather drive off a cliff or jump off a balcony, or I'll kill myself before. And you know what? That's not helpful at all. And I understand that, particularly when it comes to family members, what they're expressing is a lot of raw grief and emotion about, you know, it is hurting my heart to watch somebody I love going through these changes. And I understand and appreciate that. And that is, you know, certainly not the time, right, for me to say, you know what, you might want to think about how you talk about it. We do circle back around to that, but typically at a different time. But in a general, broader sense, if we're using that type of language, we're saying this is something that, you know, I would rather have a violent end to my life than to be a part of that experience. Why is that? And I think part of it is because we as professionals are not typically great at saying, here is how you can still connect when people no longer have the ability to use words. Here is how you can still connect when people are confused and not get into arguments. Here is how you can still have positive experiences. Here is what quality of life looks like, right? And again, there's that big disconnect between maybe what I view as quality of life in my life right now versus what you might see with somebody who is, let's say, 7 years into Alzheimer's disease, right? So It's easy for people in my position, i.e. a 48-year-old independent woman, right, a professional woman, versus somebody who is, let's say, 77 and 7 years into Alzheimer's disease. And I would say a couple of things to that. One is quality of life is always subjective to the person who's living it, right? Okay. So when I was 11, my quality of life and my ideas about quality of life looked a lot different than they do right now. I think we can all remember as kids thinking, you know, when I'm a grown up, I'm going to stay up all night, every night. I'm not going to have a bedtime. And then how long does it take us after college to realize, like, there's a reason you go to bed at a decent hour, right? You have to be functional the next day, right? So things change with life experience. And also, like, when I was 9, I think my parents had a very hard time getting me out of roller skates. Like, I wanted to roller skate everywhere. I wanted to wear roller skates in the house. I was all about roller skates. That was like the ultimate. It's been, I'd say, a solid 30 years since I've had roller skates on, at least. So again, you know, what's important to us right now in this moment in our own lives is not necessarily what's important to someone in the disease process. And I think a great example of this, I was interviewed a few years ago for an article in the Portland Tribune, and the idea was, would you want to know, would you want to have genetic testing to see if this is something?
Very common question.
Right, exactly. And in the course of answering that question, I was telling a story about one of my clients who was probably 12 years into the disease process at that time. And I had, just the day before, I had brought her roses for Mother's Day. She never had children. She had always wanted to. I don't think she had any awareness that it was Mother's Day, but I did. And her husband had told me at one point that he was always too cheap to buy her roses, even though he knew she loved them. And he always felt really bad about that. And he hadn't been in a position to do that for her that day. And so I brought her roses. And her face just lit up. She was so happy. Maybe she couldn't say roses. She knew what they were. She was so happy. And then when she held them, she stuck her face in them and did a big, just, you know, a deep breath, experiencing the perfume of the roses. I can tell you, in that moment, I don't know anything that could have made her happier.
Right.
Was she experiencing quality of life? Absolutely she was. Yeah, it was a big deal to her. And I think, you know, when we dismiss something like that by saying, well, you know, gosh, if that was me, I'd rather drive off a cliff. By extension, we're saying her life doesn't have any value.
Right.
Because she can't have a conversation in the way we can right now. Or it just focuses a lot on can't, on loss, instead of looking at what's happening right now. What can somebody do? How can we help them do something they enjoy? What value is there right now? And how can we magnify that even more?
That's a really good point. And I'd like to mention that, you know, even the everyone wants to know, well, what stage is your loved one in? And when you look at that clinical, the stages, it all focuses on loss. There's nothing, nothing that focuses on remaining abilities. And so people don't understand to focus on the remaining abilities and the quality of life.
Right. And I understand with stages, you know, that can be important for planning purposes,
sure,
right?
Of course.
It can definitely be important for safety, important for understanding and meeting and anticipating care needs. All of that's really important, but I think you're right. There needs to be the flip side of that. And that's what I try to do when I'm working with clients is, okay, this is the stage right now. And so what that means is here's the best way to be successful right now. Right.
True.
So if we know that somebody isn't, for example, if they're at a point where they do not easily recall others' names, I'm going to teach my clients that at this point, you're going to really want to focus on facial expressions, right? You're going to want to focus on that energy. And I teach people techniques on how to connect on that level instead of relying on words. And so, again, it goes back to, which we've talked about before, addition before subtraction. So, hey, here are all these positive things. Yes, it's also true that this other stuff is happening. Of course it is. I'm not going to try and talk you out of reality. It is happening. But I've just given you or taught you or shown you or practiced with you all of these other tips, techniques, tricks that can be used to stay connected. And I think that has a lot of value and it helps people see what value is there.
I absolutely agree. I actually took the stages and laid them out in a spreadsheet and added columns so that to help people identify what's still the positive stuff, what ability still remains. So not as
I love that.
It was a part of a training tool that I've provided, and it's on, I'll share it in the show notes for our listeners who might be interested in seeing that.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. That's wonderful. I look forward to seeing it. I had a client that I just adored, and this family was terrific. And one of the issues kind of historically in that family had been that they were buttoned up emotionally. Right. And so that just wasn't something that was easily expressed. And it had to do with cultural background. And one of the siblings was having a really tough time with managing his own emotions around how it was watching the disease progression. And the other sibling said, well, there has to be something here. He was looking for meaning in it. And so I said, well, you know, when somebody is getting on your dad about, you know, the story repeating, right? You know, we've already heard that story. Encourage him to keep going. You're going to be surprised. You'll hear more things. He'll circle back. You'll get more detail. And so what happened shortly after that was they had a Thanksgiving dinner. And sure enough, dad started telling the same story. And the one son just kind of pulled their chairs a little bit away from the table so that he could really focus and intently listen and not be distracted by anybody else at the table. And he not only learned some new stuff, his dad, who'd been so emotionally buttoned up his whole life, at the end of it, grabbed his son's hands and said, I'm so proud of you. You're such a good boy. And, you know, he had never heard those words before out of his dad. He knew his dad loved him, but he had never heard, I'm so proud of you. And because he hung in there and it created that moment of intimacy, really, where, you know, he was just a captive or an interested audience and all in on what his dad was saying, that his dad just, you know, was at the point where he wasn't as inhibited and he was just feeling close to his son and he said what came to his mind. And his son told me later, you know, that was a gift I would have never known to look for. I never thought I would hear those words. And that, wow. So there is so much that is still there. And we unfortunately, I think we miss it a lot because of this kind of attitude of, oh, lights are on, nobody's home, that kind of really snarky nonsense that misses the point of we're talking about a human being who still has contributions to make and feelings and wants to connect with us.
I'm just reflecting back when I, before I knew even how to spell Alzheimer's and all the misconceptions and negative perceptions, I guess, that I had in my mind. And I've never cared personally for a person. I've never had a family member with the disease, but I've definitely learned a lot from others, and I'm enjoying trying to help change the culture on how we talk about it and how we can help make it a positive experience as best as possible. And but so what do you think, what else do you think, if anything, that professionals or care partners can do to help continue to change the way we talk about dementia?
I think there are two really important things. One is, if we make up our minds that we are going to be sort of ambassadors, right? And so when we hear somebody saying something like, well, I'd rather jump off a balcony than ever let that happen to me, or, oh, they're crazy, that type of thing, to be an ambassador, and I use that word very specifically because that implies there's some diplomacy involved, right? So people are most open to correction when we can do it in a kind and loving way, not when we're at them or, wagging a finger at them. If we can just say, oh, that, I've heard a lot of people say that in my time. And, one thing I've noticed in going through this experience with my parent or my spouse, right? If you start off that way, kind of bringing it into, hey, I've got some personal experience here, maybe I can shed some light on this for you. That's one way to be a good ambassador. And then if people just say something like, she's just crazy. Actually, she has a medical diagnosis.
True. Very true.
So sometimes you can just, it's a quick little thing and people go, oh, okay. So, and I think part of being a good ambassador too is not attributing evil motives to when people are using some unpreferred language. So being an ambassador, that's one. And then the other thing is, and I do understand, believe me, I understand, because of experiences in my personal life and then also having worked on the other side inside communities, this is a highly emotional time for a family. It is really tough, and I do get that. That said, I really want families to understand that they have so much more power than they're using. Mm. And I am not in any way trying to make light of the situation, but I am going to run a little analogy here. And that is, if you were a consumer of any other product, you would act very differently. You would stand up for yourself more. You wouldn't think of accepting some of the nonsense that can happen in some of these communities. Okay. And kind of the insider joke is we say, a good place to live is a community, but when it's a really bad building, then we use the F word. We right. say facility. When things aren't going the way that they should inside a community, as a consumer, you need to pipe up and say, this is unacceptable. Because as far as I know, no community is saying, come live here for free. There's no money involved. You just come on in and we'll provide, five-star service. That's not what they're saying. You are paying for a service. And the service is, I know that I can go home and sleep through the night because my parent or partner is safe, is well cared for, is happy, and is being treated with dignity and respect. And should be kindness, compassion, and empathy as well. So if you can't say those things, something is wrong. And, you know, that is the time to pipe up and demand that it be different. A good place to live, a place where people are being valued for who they are, and it's a positive environment that's looking at creating more positive experiences, right, and valuing the people who live there, is not a place that you walk in and people are slumped over and drooling in front of a TV. That's not a good place. You know, it's not a place where you walk in and people are coloring kittens from a toddler coloring book, right? That's not, no. There might be one person in the place who really wants to do that. And if that's the case, okay. But you should never see a group of people doing that. That's, you know, they're not children. They're adults who've led full lives. There are other ways to have artistic expression. You shouldn't walk into a place and see a bunch of people crowded around a nurse's station being told, you know, sit down. Or you shouldn't walk in and hear continuous, help me, or people right. crying out, right? Right. You should see people who are running to respond to that when people cry out for help. So I'm not saying that anybody or that a living situation has to be perfect. I know at my house, it's not perfect. I have four dogs, so the carpeting is not necessarily delightful. But, you know, there are standards. And if we don't demand that those standards be met, it's really hard to see change happen. I started working inside a community 17 years ago, and I've definitely seen changes in the right direction over that period of time. I absolutely have. But you know what? The whole culture change movement has been happening for at least 10 years.
Okay.
I don't see significant across the board changes because, again, this is such a highly emotional time that I think families feel like, you know, we were lucky to get a place here, or, you know, there's so much else going on. And this is what I mean, going back to societal attitudes about dementia, that's not good enough. Somebody having a bed to sleep in and a roof over their head and three meals a day, that's not good enough. These are human beings that need social interaction. They need love. You know, they need help with care, and they need to be treated with dignity and respect. And it is totally okay to demand that. And I've written about this extensively. You can probably tell I'm on my soapbox right now, and I'll send in some links, Mike. Maybe you can put those in the show notes for this, but with some specific techniques on how to get what you want, what needs to happen when you're interacting with care staff.
Then that's excellent. I look forward to sharing that in the show notes, Christy. But I am going to have to ask you if you have any one last final thought as we wrap up today's conversation.
I guess I would just say that even though you may not feel like you're making a big impact, when you can, with your person, just look for how to meet them in their moment, then you're having a positive impact on that person, right? And if you happen to be in the presence of other people, you're just spreading those seeds.
True.
You know, of course, I'd love to see change happen overnight. I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. I know that it unfortunately doesn't happen that way, but everything we do to create a more positive outcome, more positive experience, does help keep us moving in the right direction. So what you do makes a difference.
So thank you, Christy, for joining us today and helping us to understand how we can go about changing negative attitudes in society and changing the way we talk about dementia so that we can make it a more positive and loving experience for our care partners out there around the world.
I like it. That's a great goal. Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
Be sure to visit the show notes at togetherinthis.com/episode33 for links to all the referenced resources. And don't forget, Christy is a regular guest here on the Alzheimer's podcast, so be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Bye now. You've been listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness. For more information and to get the resources mentioned in this episode, visit togetherness.com/podcast.